Now, TV shows and movies are full of portrayals of jury trials. Whether it's a panel of citizens listening to compelling evidence presented by attorneys and witnesses, or thoughtful, sometimes heated deliberations taking place as members of the jury argue for what they feel is the most just and appropriate verdict, we probably all have an image in our heads. But our next guest says that the constitutional right to be judged by a panel of your peers is in danger of disappearing, and that fewer and fewer cases are going to trial, let alone before a jury. Drury Sherrod, Ph.D., is the co-founder of Mattson and Sherrod Incorporated, a jury research firm specializing in trial strategy and jury selection. He's a member of the American Society of Trial Consultants, the American Psychological Association, and the Society for Experimental Social Psychology. A prolific author, his latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Drury, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Where does the right to be tried by a jury of our peers come from?
It comes from the Magna Carta originally. It originated in little Anglo-Saxon villages about 900 years ago. And then over the years, it was brought to America of the colonies and then as part of the United States Constitution. So the Sixth and Seventh Amendment in the Constitution guarantee the right to trial by jury. One pertains to criminal trials, one pertains to civil trials.
And so we're talking a millennium ago in England. What did it look like then to be tried by a jury of your peers?
Fairly different from what we know as a jury trial today. Originally, there was the king's officer would ride into town, assemble a group of local men. They were always men. They were of similar status. And then they would. There were no evidence. There were no witnesses. There were no cross-examinations or examinations. These local villagers would simply discuss together what they had heard about the person. Take a typical Anglo-Saxon name, Godric. They would talk about old Godric, and they would say, well, you know, he's not the kind of guy who would do this. Or somebody else would say, he's starting to change, I've heard. So they would talk for about an hour or so and then reach a verdict. And for many centuries, that was the nature of trial by jury. It was called self-informing jurors, that they didn't listen to evidence. They just judged based on what they knew about the alleged the person who was accused of a problem.
And then bringing it up to today in the United States, who do we think of as a peer for someone who has been charged with a crime?
It's a huge problem. The courts have over and over defined it, said that what we have in the U.S. is a jury of one's peers. But it's very hard to know what is a peer. There's lots of problems. One is that most people who, 15% of people never receive a jury summons because they've changed address or haven't left a new address or something like that. Another, about 12% receives a summons and ignores it. That, you already take about a quarter or a third off the sample. And then when people come to trial, jury selections are, you know, often people get excuses pretty easily, especially in state courts where judges are elected, so judges don't want to be unpopular. There are lots of strikes. Attorneys can strike a juror for cause if the juror admits that they're too biased to be on the trial. Also, jurors are struck with peremptory strikes when an attorney just would say, I don't like the way that person is looking at me.
Hmm. You write that fewer and fewer cases are going to trial at all. Why would that be?
Well, that is the crisis, the jury crisis today. The exact figures are about, this is amazing, 0.5% of all the civil trials that ever are filed in a year ever see a jury. That's 0.5%. That's down from about 20 to 25% in the 1980s. And if you look at criminal trials, it's less than 1% of all criminal trials filed in a year ever see a jury. So that's been referred to, I think you used the phrase, the death of trial by jury, or the vanishing jury, or the disappearing jury.
And why is that? Why would that change so much in a relatively short amount of time?
Partly is that jurors have developed a bad reputation. Jurors are demeaned, dismissed, denigrated, their verdicts ridiculed. Now, invariably, whenever I work with attorneys on jury trials, someone mentions the McDonald's coffee case, which was widely seen as a nutty verdict that a lady who spilled coffee was awarded $2.7 million in damages. There's lots more to the story that makes it somewhat more plausible. But one of the big reasons is that jurors, there are all these high-profile celebrity trials. For example, in the first Bill Cosby case where he was tried for sexual assault, jurors deliberated for 52 hours, which is longer than even the length of the evidence. And they spent a whole day, they said, when they were interviewed afterwards by reporters, they spent a whole day debating the meaning of reckless, and finally sent a note to the judge to define reckless. And the judge wrote back that they had to use their own common sense understanding of what it meant. So jurors are mistrusted. Jurors often don't seem to be able to perform what's required of them in terms of understanding evidence, arriving at a reasonable verdict, engaging in deliberations that are expected as deliberations.
So does that mean that lawyers are then counseling their clients to, for instance, take a plea or opt for a bench trial or somehow trying to avoid actually having their case go in front of a jury?
That's exactly what's happening. In criminal trials, plea bargaining has replaced trial by jury. In civil trials, that's when corporations sue each other or a person sues a corporation. In civil trials, they either settle or it goes into what's called ADR, alternative dispute resolution, which is where the case is turned over to mediators or arbitrators. And I bet in almost any contract you've signed or whenever you're on the web and you click that little box that says agree to terms, you're agreeing to waive your right to trial by jury if you have a dispute with a product you ordered or, say, if the cell phone contracts are notorious. I looked at my cell phone contracts and noticed that in three different places in large, black, oversized type, it requires you to waive your right to trial by jury and agree to binding arbitration.
We're talking with Drury Sherrod right now. He is an expert in trial strategy and jury selection, and his latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we did ask our listeners, Drury, on Facebook to tell us about their experiences of being on juries. Paul on Facebook said, seems to work just fine in my county, and he said it's Racine County here in Wisconsin. Dave on Facebook said, I was the foreman on a jury for a civil case. I thought the system worked well. We shared our views and came up with what we felt was a just verdict. And so it's interesting because granted, it's just two anecdotal comments, but there's the perception, like you said, of, you know, for instance, that McDonald's coffee, a hot coffee case, there's a perception of maybe a system that's gone off the rails, but then some people who are actually involved in jury deliberations say, yeah, actually, you know, it worked pretty well.
I think actually when people tell me what can they do to get off a jury trial, I tell them you really should be on the jury. And often people find it ennobling. It really, it's a moral experience for them, and they learn to sit down and deliberate with people they would never probably come across and talk to in real life. But I think it works as, if we didn't have juries, it would be bad for democracy. Trial by jury is a stepping stone on the whole goal of a democratic culture, I think.
You come at jury selection and trial strategy from a psychological perspective, and you say that the ways trials are run, how evidence is presented, and what we ask of members of a jury really runs counter to how our human minds work. How is that? What's the mismatch there?
There's so much research on how jurors actually make decisions, and it's generally called the story model of jury decision-making. And through lots of experimental research, they find actually when jurors first start hearing about a case, they begin telling a story. Like the way people understand what happened in a case is to match it to a similar event in their own life. And so very early in any kind of case, the jurors will start telling a story. And surprisingly, about two-thirds of jurors in most cases have decided how to vote on the verdict during the opening statement before they've heard any evidence at all. And partly this is because a lot of psychologists, including Daniel Kahneman, who's the founder of behavioral economics, a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, economist, he said that the brain evolved to jump to conclusions based on narratives that we draw from our own lives, not on methodical analytic evaluation of evidence. So we have this built-in bias to jump to a conclusion. We jump to that conclusion early in the opening statement, and then that influences what we attend to during the cases in chief and how we recall it. And when we sit down to deliberate, it influences the stories we tell to our fellow jurors.
And I'm guessing then, as we hear different testimonies or items of evidence, and whether it's coming from the prosecution or the defense, if completely unconsciously we've already started making a decision, the things that agree with us are the things that stick, that confirmation bias comes through.
That's partly because we actually see different worlds without even realizing it. We did a nice study in my jury research firm. We had done lots of auto defect allegation cases. So we ran a huge study with about 5,000 subjects to see how plaintiff jurors in an auto defect case differ from defense jurors. And plaintiff jurors actually saw different worlds. They had more experience with accidents or injuries. They feared injury. They doubted they could protect themselves from injuries. They evaluated risk and harm differently. So you can see how in a case where jurors had to decide if an automobile was defectively designed or not, if they start off appraising the nature of risk and the nature of danger and the nature of harm and hazard entirely differently, they're going to have a hard time sitting down to deliberate.
We're talking with Drury Sherrod right now. He's an expert in trial strategy and jury selection, and his new book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever served on a jury? What was that experience like? How hard was it to sort through the information you were given and to understand the legal aspects of the case? Did you feel good about the verdict that was returned? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson. We're picking up our conversation with trial strategy and jury selection expert Drury Sherrod. His new book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you were on trial, would you rather have a jury or a judge decide your fate? If you served on a jury, what was the experience like, and was it what you expected it to be? For better or worse, do you feel like you have a more realistic idea of how our justice system works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Drury, you talked about how jurors process information as stories, not just as facts that they accumulate, and then at the end they make your decision. What about the issue of having to understand some fairly arcane legal points, as you were saying, the jurors in the first Bill Cosby trial? How does that play into this?
I think the important thing about stories that I would like to make sure that it's clear is that if attorneys see a jury trial as a contest between stories, not as a contest between evidence, but as a contest between stories, then it's incumbent on the attorneys to organize the evidence into stories. And the story model of jury research shows that jurors are much more persuaded by a narrative organization of evidence than a chronological. Typically, what most attorneys will do is have a yellow pad, maybe 50 points, they just check off each one, and they'll say, this witness will testify about this point, another witness will testify about this point. Then as the witnesses are called, they appear out of order, more or less when it's convenient for them to fly in. It's very hard for the juror's brain to assemble all that information. So one of my main recommendations in the book is for attorneys to think like jurors, to think like storytellers, rather than like law school professors who are presenting evidence.
And you said that a large proportion of jurors actually begin or even complete making their decision during the opening statements. And it seems to me like the opening statements and probably the closing statements are the most narrative parts of the trial.
Actually, there are three opportunities. There's the pre-voir dire overview, when the attorney gets to explain to jurors something about what the case is about. So when they're questioned during voir dire, they'll be able to say something like, that happened to me, and I'm already biased in this case. I can't be a good juror. The other place is the opening statements, and that's where the jurors begin to make up their minds, two-thirds to three-quarters before the evidence. And then the final, you would think, closing arguments would be another time to try to persuade jurors. But by then, jurors have firmly made up their minds. Closing arguments don't do much to change their minds. The closing arguments should be used to retell the story and point out how each of the witnesses fits into the total story.
Brandy on Facebook said she was called for jury duty twice in 2 months, never before, never since. And she says, I think the main challenge is for jurors to understand the law and the concept of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that something that you see emerging as you look at many different cases and how they turn out?
The word reasonable is one of those very interesting terms that different people perceived differently. Now, what's reasonable to one person is not reasonable to another. A what is harmful or hazardous to one is not harmful or hazardous to another. It's that example I gave about people who tend to identify with plaintiffs in auto trials are much more likely to think, you know, the world is just full of huge hazards out there. I have to be aware of all these hazards, and I ought to be very clearly warned about them and very clearly informed how to avoid them. And they think that a product or a vehicle or something the manufacturer hasn't adequately warned or instructed on how to avoid, then they're going to think, this is unreasonably dangerous. So it's really interesting. You know, this point I've made is that different types of people perceive different worlds, so they tell different stories about what's going on. And that's why I think the attorneys have to think like a juror instead of like a judge. And also, I think you asked about judges' instructions. There's so much evidence that judges' instructions just go over jurors' heads. Mm-hmm. The recent El Chapo trial, I think the judge gave, I read this, 3 hours of instructions. And jurors had to decide on 54 different verdict questions. And it took them, I think, 7 days to do that. But lots of research suggests that judges' instructions would be better understood if they were put at the beginning of a trial instead of at the end of all the evidence. Because it's when you think about it, the instructions are to really telling a jury, like, this is what you have to find to prove guilt or innocence. And so they should know that at the outset, because that would help them decide what to attend to, instead of after weeks of evidence and hearing, let's say, an hour of judges' instructions and finally thinking, oh, I think I see what I'm supposed to have done.
Hmm. We're talking with Drury Sherrod about his new book, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And let's go to the phones, and Nancy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I was on a very interesting trial one time. A man and a woman had been living together but not married for close to 30 years. The man died and left a will giving to the woman a valuable violin, a sum of money, and many personal effects. But he reserved the majority of his worldly goods to his brothers and sisters. Well, the woman pressed a suit claiming that she had loved him, cooked for him, cleaned for him, and took care of him in his final illness for 30 years, and therefore she should be entitled to his property as a common law wife. Well, we went to deliberate eventually, and a very high-powered type A personality man, obviously an executive of some kind, took charge of the jury and really manipulated the whole thing. It was very obvious he was eager to get out of there. It turned out that that because this man had left a will, clearly elucidating in the will what he wanted his lover to have, that was paramount, and therefore the woman would only get those things, and therefore she lost her suit. Now, every other woman in the room voted that she should get half the property. I was the only woman who voted with this high-powered type man, because I truly did feel that he had clearly pointed out what he wanted her to have. So when we left that room, every other woman was extremely angry with me and talked to me very harshly.
And I'm going to leave it there, Nancy, because we're getting a little short on time. Thank you for giving us that insight into your experience. James on Facebook says he served on a jury for a civil case involving the family of a child and an insurance company fighting over money paid out for a dog bite. He says, I had a feeling some of the jurors on the side that eventually found for the insurance company were letting their own personal political beliefs get in the way of the facts. I probably should have told the judge, but for some reason, I didn't. And Drury, it's interesting because it's clear from our caller and from our Facebook commenter that, you know, we're not going in there as blank slates. We are going into a deliberation with a whole set of experiences and perspectives.
No, using the story model, the fact is it influenced the stories that we tell are called stored scripts. They're scripts about similar events from our own lives. So as soon as we start hearing of the case, as I said earlier, that's when we start thinking, oh, yeah, you know, if this was a dog bite case, you know, I had a similar dog bite case, and my neighbor told me about a dog. And so they start telling us. Then, and then what's really interesting is in deliberations, almost half of what jurors say was never mentioned in court. It's just anecdotes from their own lives that help support the verdict they reached.
Drury, I'm curious, if you were charged with a crime and had the choice, would you go before a jury or would you opt for a bench trial?
I would go before a jury. I mean, first, the reason is that it's an error to see judges or arbitrators or mediators as free of bias. They are just as biased because they have the same brains that jurors do. They also resort to stories. They just may resort to different types of stories, but they're not bias-free. And if you accept that they're not bias-free, then I think it's much better to spread the bias across 6 to 12 people who you would find on a jury instead of vesting it in one expert, one arbitrator, or one judge. And additionally, we've done, when in my jury research firm, when we were preparing attorneys for bench trials, we would hire panels of retired judges, and they would get dense packets of information, they would listen to the case, they would deliberate, and then they would reach verdicts in questionnaires. And analyzing the questionnaires showed that judges would split among themselves about which side was right or wrong. And if and when they did decide to, jointly that one side was right, they would have different reasons for deciding it. So judges are just as biased as humans and arrive at just as diverse reasons and decisions, and probably from their own lives.
Well, Drury, thank you so much for joining us today. Really interesting conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Drury Sherrod is the co-founder of Mattson & Sherrod Incorporated, a jury research firm specializing in trial strategies and jury selection. His latest book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. And you can continue the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you served on a jury? What was that like? How did you feel that you were making your decision? Was it, as Drury said, based on the story that made sense to you, or was it trying to put together a large mass of facts that may or may not be connected in a narrative? Share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.